our latest Imaginary Vice Chancellor in the My Imaginary University podcast series is Paul Clark, formerly of HESA and UCL, and now an independent strategy consultant. Paul has created a novel institution which is rooted in the past, but with an eye very much to the future. There aren't huge numbers of students on campus at this super connected ivory tower of an institution, but it does have a large online presence. It's a full service university, but with a strong leaning towards the humanities, a huge research budget, and a temperate Northern European location. The university enjoys a light touch regulatory environment and a campus which combines the tradition of All Souls with the modernity of Apple's Californian HQ. Paul sees himself as something of a compassionately ruthless vice-chancellor, but is nevertheless extremely supportive of the student experience, even if he is largely in favour of banning most academic dress. Certainly ain't no party and it ain't no disco at this most distinctive of institutions. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome, everyone, to the latest edition of My Imaginary University. My name's Paul Greatrix, and on the podcast today, it's my huge pleasure to introduce Paul Clark. Paul Clark is formerly chief executive at HESA, the Higher Education Statistics Agency, and vice president strategy at UCL, and is now an independent strategy consultant. So welcome, Paul. I'm very excited to talk to you and hear what imaginary university you've come up with today. I'm just imagining it's going to be A, really data heavy, and B, really strategic, but I don't know what form that would actually take. So I'm very excited to find out. So it's great to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks very much. And you're absolutely right. There is a data flavor to it, as you would imagine.
Fantastic. So let's dive straight in there. And just to make it clear, I've got absolutely no idea what kind of imaginary university, how fantastic or indeed how grounded Paul's creation might be. So we're just going to explore with a bit of discussion what kind of institution it is. So, Paul, give us the headlines, right? Give us the top level view of this university and the kind of institution it is and where it is and how big it is, etc. Give us the headlines.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, thank you. So the headlines, I think, are that there are a number of sort of countervailing forces around this. If I could start with such a kind of grandiose phrase. The first is that I'm a big fan of the monastic origins of universities. So we know, you know, universities go back to kind of medieval monasteries. It's how they started, what their foundations are, particularly in Western Europe. But also coupling that with a really high-tech, data-driven organization. So what their foundations are and where they are now. And where I think some of the sort of contradictions are as I'm thinking about this imaginary university, as we become more technology-driven, we also need to be more human. And as we become more massified as a kind of higher education system, we also need to be more bespoke. And as we become more science and technology dominated, we also need more humanities as well. So those are the kind of framing points I would make at the start of this. So we've got these big forces going on at the moment. I think universities feel a lot of these pressures. So my imaginary university will be placed right in the crux and the fulcrum of these different developments and dynamics that are taking place at the moment.
So I'm still thinking, I'm very focused on the monastic origins, but yeah. But I think what you're suggesting is it's true to the you know, the kind of traditions and ideals of the original medieval university, but it actually in the contemporary mode, it's very people focused as well as data focus. It's human.
Yeah, exactly.
It's real.
It's
absolutely
human.
Digital.
So the monastic point is that it's a slightly sort of flippant one. Don't expect people to, you know, take holy orders or any of that kind of stuff. But creating a space solely dedicated to thought and reflection and community and service and those kinds of ethos, where you can step out of the routine of life, particularly when it's so frenetic and the digital, Digital information just kind of swamps us all the time. So I think just having that, creating that space, if it didn't exist, you would probably need to invent it. So having some of that sort of foundation, and where the bespoke point comes in is that I think online education, digital education, we're not quite there yet, but I think there's no future, there's no universe in which that's not a massive part of the future. So I think there would be a big kind of online, technology driven component, but at the same time, that needs to really sort of drive up a much more bespoke human student experience. So in terms of numbers, I would anticipate there being not a huge number of students in the kind of physical space, but a much larger number of people being reached online. And while you have a kind of high quality online experience, you've got to have then an even more high quality experience for the people who are coming on campus, and it's got to really mean something to them. So the models there are not some, moving slightly away from the monastery to a bit more towards a 7-star hotel kind of experience with the kind of concierge and that kind of ethos as well.
Okay, this is we'll come on to the what happens in the digital space and the kind of subject matter thing. But just to linger a little bit on your the kind of melding of the kind of cloisters and the connectedness of the digital world in a 7-star hotel vibe, right? I mean, it really does create the impression of a kind of an Oxbridge College, but with luxury environments and incredibly fast broadband. I mean, that's what I'm kind of thinking. All the technical fripperies, but with kind of a sense, a real sense of history, but as you say, of calm and of space and reflective environments. So it's a kind of connected ivory tower, as it were.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, I wouldn't. That's your phrase, not my phrase. I wouldn't use that one. I think the luxury point is more. It's less about the kind of the physicality and the fripperies and those. It's much more about the human focused service. So that becomes much more important. And then if we get on to talk about that in the kind of perspectives and the course structure and those kind of things, then I think that's where you might see that coming through. But we're going to have an experience 10, 20, 30 years time where these things are going to be expected if they're not already, to have that really smooth, really kind of human focused, individualized experience on campus as well as the digital one. And so it's more in that vein rather than you having to have, certain kinds of attributes, physical attributes.
Okay. Right. Let's broaden it out a little bit then. So in terms of, so it's a relatively small student population in physical on campus term, but a much bigger remote one in different ways. But you focused right at the beginning on saying, this is, a large part of this was about the humanities and the importance of that. So in terms of the range of courses on offer, that kind of portfolio programs, and the I assume you've got a research agenda as well. So how does, is it all biased towards the humanities, or is it a kind of full service operation?
More or less full service. So again, some of the sort of points come in. I think if we thinking future ahead and about the impact of AI, all organizations are going to be data organizations at some point in the future if they're not already. So that's going to be a kind of critical part. But if we think about if some of the prognostications about AI come true, and just take one example, is that there's the view that AI is going to solve economic problems. Okay, it's going to solve a lot of the workforce issues that we might face. So that means that universities need to become about something else, in addition to thinking about how we're going to, control, manage, moderate, think about the impact of AI and what it can do in various domains. And that something else is where the humanities come in. So this question that I said at the start about as we become more tech driven, we need to become more human, needs to be reflected in the curriculum. So the curriculum would need to emphasize those areas which are about our humanity, what it means to be human, how we express that, what our heritage is, and what the future of that might be in a world where a lot of the economic and technological areas are going to be theoretically, possibly dealt with much more by AI. So I'd want to see a kind of breadth of curriculum, which is around, say, art, design, humanities, social sciences, in addition to the engineering, technology and biological sciences. Something like you get in the kind of smaller European universities like Aalto, Sciences Po, those kinds of places. But exacerbated. And I think it's a real opportunity for a real revival around the humanities, actually. And then we can see that already in some of the debates about AI. You know, some of these subjects which have fallen out of fashion potentially are becoming much more important, like philosophy, like theology, like religious studies, ethics. These kind of questions are coming much, much more into the mainstream. And I think that will kind of continue in the future. And I think the humanities also, where I see the more human dimension also being expressed, is around questions of fairness, inclusivity, inequality as well, which I think they are important now. I think they're only going to become even more important. So I want to see those things really kind of ingrained into the curriculum. What I would want to avoid is the kind of sense that all subjects end up being sort of melded into a sort of interdisciplinary cloud, you know, which I don't think would be helpful or where things should go. So there's a distinctiveness around the subjects, but nevertheless, I think some of the ones that potentially neglected in the past could become more important in the future. And things worth preserving.
Yeah.
Ancient languages, cultures, really worth preserving. Yeah. Even more so, I think, in the future. And it's difficult to predict which ones are going to be valuable, are going to be useful in the future. So this is a place for universities, a place to have that conversation and to preserve those things.
And is the, I mean, it sounds from how you've described it that the likelihood is that the research agenda of the university will very much match that kind of set of aspirations you just set out there.
100%. I mean, again, this is imaginary, so I'd obviously want to see the research budgets of a kind of Google, of the big tech companies, and apply to the principles of, you know, QR.
We'll know
how valuable QR is, you know, that non-prescriptive blue skies kind of research, university, you know, PI-led approach. You know, we see the changes that we make, and I'm, you know, a big fan of the kind of Mariana Mazzucati view, the entrepreneurial state, the contribution that the public investment and public universities make to innovation really kind of rings true. So I think obviously extremely large amounts of money channeled in a way that and deployed in a way that academics think is best seems to me to be a great way forward, recognizing, as I say, this is not the reality necessarily we live in, and I know the sector constantly has to make the case around QR and those kinds of funding, but I think it definitely will be something that's just worth making.
So let's face it, you're worth it, right?
100%.
You referenced a number of European continental universities, and I wonder, as kind of influences on the design of the institution. So in your head, is this a university that is very much based on the continent, or have you gone for somewhere, you know, with a better climate, or where are you, where's the HQ?
Difficult to say. I think probably would be, I would favor European, northern European side. In my mind, I envisage a physical institution that has the presence of the Apple HQ at Cupertino. It's got this kind of, you know, that kind of fantastic building that's really is designed around people. Again, you know, assuming budgets are not a problem here, it's designed around people, like how they actually interact, how they work, how they come together, very much with that kind of more human ethos. But the building itself then can be part of the experimental approach of the university. You can use the building itself, for design experiments, for biological experiments, sociology, policy, regulation, all of these kind of subjects can be enacted in the physical state of the building. So I think I'd have something which is, you know, looks like the Apple HQ. It's got the ethos of probably All Souls College. And it's got at its heart, and this is a bit of a personal, it's got a library that's modelled on the sort of the name of the rose, the Umberto Eco Library, with its, goes back to the kind of, the monastic point around. But what I love about that is the kind of sanctity and reverence for learning in the at the heart of this place. But I don't think, from a personal point of view, I think I'm just more northern European than Californian.
Right. Okay. That's what's helpful to know what students need to pack when they arrive. So, but thinking further then about students, it's a very, you know, it's a really nice picture again of the blending of the historical and the contemporary, and indeed the future facing. In terms of what the student can expect, then what is the kind of student experience in this very distinctive campus setting in Northern Europe?
That seems to be where we've ended up, isn't it? Northern Europe. What I would say, just on the physical point of view, is that I wouldn't want it to be too remote, because I've obviously seen a lot of universities that are make a fantastic contribution to their local places. There's, I can think of TESOD, I can think of the Art Gallery at Goldsmiths, I can think of things that are opened up to their communities. So it's not like the tiger's nest in Tibet, we're not talking that. So something a little bit between, but it's got a space where you can withdraw a bit. So I think, the student experience, it would be as individualized on campus as possible, but I think having those spaces for minds to be changed, for discussion and debate to take place, for interaction from similar but also more diverse cultures as well, all of those things I think are more and more important, as we see with the kind of some of the wider debates going on at the moment. So I think it would, if you come into the campus, that's the kind of thing that you would absolutely be able to expect. I think with the online side of things, it's emerging, it's developing. We saw a big shift through the pandemic. Personally, I think there's a really long way still to go and a lot of potential around that to make that a really kind of high quality. It's never going to be an equivalent experience, but make it really high quality experience. But it seems to me that it has to be part of the future. So whatever that looks like, it needs to be, really high quality, really high production values, and again, individually focused.
So is there a clear divide between the student on campus experience and the online, so there is no kind of hybrid model with some kind of block release system or anything like that? It is very much you're either online or you're here in person.
Yeah, I think so. And again, I know there are different views around this, but that would just seem to me to be a natural way that things would evolve as the online experience becomes better and better. Then it's got to be more and more of a reason for students to come to campus and to have that experience. So it's got to be different if technology and automation are much more part of their lives away from this and are going to be in their working lives. Then it's got to be something which is specifically human and human level and human scale around what they're doing on campus. So it's got to be, quote your phrase from earlier, it's got to be worth it.
Yeah.
And it's got to be valuable.
And presumably we're talking about a diverse international community of students and indeed staff. It's a very mixed group that you're
Diverse in international sense, diverse in other ways as well. All the ways that you would expect to see or would hope to see, I think, in a university, with the differences and the diverse nature of the student population really acknowledged and dealt with. And I think that's, again, we see some of this sort of polarization in the digital sphere, and I think universities remain a place, and it's a really important point here, so they remain a place where those kind of different communities can come together and those debates and discussions can be had in a safe way. And we've seen some examples, I think, recently where that is and isn't the case. But I think it's extremely important, and it's only going to become more important that universities retain that role, because there's no real other place, I think, where that can happen.
And of course, by citing yourself somewhere vaguely in Northern Europe, you are freed from the shackles of the UK regulatory regime as well. So you're liberated in terms of how you operate, which must be a smart move, I'd have to say, on on your part?
I think so. I think, I mean, from my, you know, from what I know of European regulatory regimes, that kind of autonomy is earned. So after a certain point, then you prove yourself, demonstrate, and you earn your ability to self-regulate, arguably to a greater extent than doing quite where we are in the UK, even though that may be the aspiration. Again, it's a bit of a personal point, but I don't think we necessarily look as much to Europe and to other European countries for models of things that work effectively as we could do. I think there's a lot to learn from that, as well as having a slightly personal proclivity for the climate and the geography and the landscape, which is obviously
but you've got all the money, so it's fine. But the yeah. I mean, in certainly parts of European higher education, the level of actually state intervention is much higher in many respects than it is in the UK. But I think we're talking actually about operating slightly outside that framework. So and I think that's what money gets you, to be honest. You know, if you've got the freedom where you don't require large amounts of money with strings from state investors, then it's a bit of a different environment.
Yeah, I think that's we see that with American, the Ivy League institutions got very large amounts of kind of free capital to deploy, and we might look rather enviously to that from the UK. It's always been the case. There's very limited amount of that in the UK. We know the institutions that have got it. So I think you're right. Resources do give you a certain sense of autonomy. I think the other point I would make is while the form of universities over the centuries is actually remarkably resilient and consistent, and some of the longest lived institutions are universities. And so I don't see a reason to try and disrupt that, because the other point is in the recent past, actually the history of trying to disrupt the form of universities, particularly in the UK, is not particularly glorious.
Yeah.
If I can put it that way. So I don't see any reason to, this is not going into disrupting. It's just tending to try and take the best of what's has been available from the very distant past and merging it with what one might project to be the best of the near future.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can absolutely see this as yet unnamed university doing that. But so, Paul, I mean, you've been a chief executive, you've been a vice president. What kind of vice chancellor will you be of your temperate northern climbed university?
Yes. So I have worked with a lot of VCs and a lot of university leaders in my career, and most of them extremely good, some great. Absolutely recognize this extremely difficult and challenging job, and especially at the moment. So I'd obviously want to emulate those characteristics that I've seen, of those I've worked with. And some of the characteristics that I think I've noted are, there's a lot of in leadership that I want to emulate would be the intelligence, compassion, clarity of vision, inclusiveness, the sense of kind of wanting to hear from a breadth of voices, and being about the people in the institution, an obvious sympathy with the academic mission and ethos. But there's also, in some of the best leaders that I've seen up close and worked with and worked for, there's also a bit of steeliness. And I think that, there has to be that there at that level. Sometimes bordering on ruthlessness when needed, but in a compassionate way. I can't claim that's a copyrighted phrase, it's come from somewhere else, but it's but very difficult decisions have to be made on occasion, and while obviously you want to do them with some compassion and empathy, I think there's a little bit of steel that's needed to lead these kind of institutions. But looking to the tech world at the moment, the kind of models of leaders that we have, say Sundar Pichai at Google, Satya Nadella at Microsoft, these are more kind of, they're not great extroverts, they're kind of more that kind of quiet, determined leadership, inclusive leadership, bringing the people along. If I can use a football analogy, it's more kind of Carlo Ancelotti than Antonio Conte.
It's something for everyone in there, Paul. Right, okay, I get, I absolutely get that. Right, so we've talked, you know, a bit about various dimensions of this, both, you know, historically rooted and progressive, forward-looking institution. What other features of it have we not mentioned yet? There are other distinctive aspects of the university that we haven't talked about that you wanted to share.
Yeah, so on again on this human theme, I'm thinking about the on-campus and what it could provide that is difficult to get elsewhere, is so the extracurricular stuff. So things like sport and music, for example, are the things that spring to mind, both because, you know, I enjoy both of those things. I think particularly in the US, in the actually the US university sports sector, I know it's got a lot of faults and a lot of flaws around it, and it's some of the aspects of it can be problematic, but on the other hand, it's, you know, it's an intrinsic part of the higher education provision, and a lot of good thinking and development innovation has come out of that sphere. But again, it's something that's very difficult. You can't really replicate it with tech. You can't really replicate it satisfactorily in the digital sphere. So I think there's something around that. And it's similar with music, you know, live music. They're just bringing people together to continue those kinds of activities, which are very difficult to emulate in other ways, which are very human. And about having a kind of some kind of emotional empathetic connection with other people. So the extracurricular part of this, I think, would be super important.
So yeah, so there's a lot going on there, and I think there's a kind of seamless progression of the things that happen around the core student experience that runs from the very beginning of university's history as well, obviously starting off quite different but ending up, as you say, with things such as sport and music. You are presumably allowing students to organize some of this themselves, are you? I mean, there is a you know, you've got a student union and they're allowed to operate independently.
Absolutely. They, you know, would not only be allowed, it would be encouraged for them, you know, to do this. And when I talk about the kind of inclusivity and diversity, it's not something that's kind of mandated. It's something that you would obviously want to have, you know, develop and evolve from the bottom up, from the students themselves. But I think going back to that point about what universities are for, is these things are worth preserving, and spaces to have those kinds of activities, yeah, I think, are also worth preserving. But it's always been my experience that pretty much every university I've worked in, it's the students that make the university. And that would continue to be the case. And I'd just be fascinated to see what kind of students we will be able to attract to this particular campus for this particular experience.
As it's always the brightest and the best, I think you'll find, Paul.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, ones. Okay. Yeah, yeah. what that would mean, we would, I think we'd have to have a bit of a think about. We would kind of shape the student population to two great things, or craft the population, I think is the phrase from the book, whose author I can't remember, but it's very much, you know, evolution, bottom up.
We talked about the kind of regulatory environment a moment ago, yeah, but one of the things that I always invite imaginary vice chancellors to say is that, you know, given it's imaginary, you know, is there anything that you would actually ban? Because you can ban things if you want to on your campus. Is there anything you would ban?
So there's a kind of a serious point and a frivolous one. So the serious point goes back to what I was saying about universities being a space for discussion and debate. So there's very little, I think, that I'd want to ban within the law. Obviously, you'd want that to be a bit of an experimental space. The frivolous point, and I appreciate it might be slightly controversial, is academic dress. So I have... I have a slight thing about academic dress because I think in some way it just, you know, it looks odd. It's a bit hierarchical. It's quite elitist. Those aspects to it. I think I'd really want to make those kind of print media picture editors work a lot harder than they do at the moment for their visuals. But on the other hand, you know, I recognize that academic dress is an important rite of passage for graduates when they come in and they adopt it, and you're part of a community. So I think maybe not banning it altogether, but I think really, really hard about the role that academic dress plays in this particular imaginary university.
Well, given where you started, you know, with monks, I think that, you know, it's quite hard. But again, going back to your kind of, you know, aspirations for, you know, a very much a forward looking institution, and your reference. I mean, there aren't many people wearing gowns and hoods in Cupertino, are there? I mean, you know, Apple doesn't, you know, support that kind of, you know, it's all, you know, shorts and flip flops there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit more egalitarian, I think. But nevertheless, if you look at a commencement day speech, even at the kind of American universities, then you do have quite a grand set of robes and a grand kind of, you know, presentation of these things. So I think I'd definitely, while maybe not being as controversial as banning it altogether, I'd certainly want to think about what it looks like and a part it would play in the university, recognizing, as I say, there's some rite of passage involved in this.
And the idea of students rebelling by, you know, putting a mortarboard on, you know, is quite an entertaining idea. Yeah.
Well, it would be an interesting experiment to see what happened, because I think that is what happened, isn't it, when academic dress was going to be, or certainly debated at Oxford and Cambridge. It was the students who wanted to retain it. It may be that. So it may be that, you know, my approach might not work, maybe for the academic staff and certainly for the vice chancellor.
Finally then, Paul, I mean, the critical issue is your musical accompaniment. What theme song, what tune is most associated with this university?
So clearly this is the thing I thought hardest about. The song I've selected is Life During Wartime by Talking Heads. This is the Classic University theme song. Yeah, and there are two reasons for this, really. The main reason is this is a song about innovation, creativity under pressure, creativity with constraints, new ways of doing things, which seem very apposite, certainly for the times that we're in at the moment. I think the times we're going to go into in the future, notwithstanding the fact that obviously I put quite a lot of resource into this university, whether that's public or private or combination of both, I think there's still something very strong about the innovation under pressure theme, which is captured in this song. So that would be the main reason. And the other reason is just any excuse, obviously, to get a reference to the Talking Heads and to get the song played would be worthwhile, from my point of view.
And presumably you'd be inviting David Byrne to be Chancellor as well. So
obviously, if he would accept. I think his speeches might be a bit strange, but definitely worth turning up for.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, Paul, it's been fantastic talking to you and hearing this fantastic image of a new university that's both got strong historical links, but also a real eye on the future and offering a really great prospect to students from around Europe and indeed the world. It's been a really great creation. So thank you so much for putting it together for us.
No problem at all. Thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
I do hope you enjoyed that episode of My Imaginary University. There'll be more along before you know it. In the meantime, you might want to listen to the sister podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I chat to university leaders and registrars and others like that, all about their experiences of higher education. Just Google it. Also, you may want to visit my website, wonderfulhighered.com,
where you can find lots of entertaining stuff all about the strange, wonderful and frightening world of higher education. Anyway, until the next time, thank you for listening.